with sunny spells, temperatures into the low 20s here. And for northern England, a cloudy damp start to the morning, turning a bit brighter for a time with some sunny spells and perhaps a few afternoon showers, highs of 19 Celsius. Northern Ireland, largely dry and sunny, but it will cloud over towards the evening, outbreaks of rain return here. And in Scotland, rain easing off through the morning, turning brighter for the afternoon, but more rain is on the way through the nighttime, temperatures 16 or 17 degrees. That's the latest weather. Carolyn.
Thank you very much indeed, Chris. Chris Fawkes at the Weather Centre. And now we continue our book of the week, An Englishman Aboard, Discovering France in a Rowing Boat by Christopher Dimony. Charles Dimony. Charles and Inès have found the source of the Seine, the river he's planning to travel the length of in a rowing boat he's built. For the first few miles, the river is too shallow to launch the boat. But at last, a few kilometres from the small town of Châtillon-sur-Seine, the Seine becomes wide enough and deep enough to row on. Charles is able to launch his boat for the first time. The reader is Mark Heap.
At last, it was time to set off in earnest. So, with many encouraging cries of bon voyage from Inès, I took my first purposeful strokes towards the English Channel. I didn't get far. Just around the first bend, all forward progress was interrupted by a herd of cows, which were standing in the river. They were Charolais, cows with kind, somewhat vacant faces. It was clear that none of them had encountered anything quite as exciting as an unexpected rowing boat before. Their capacity for staring at me while staying completely immobile appeared limitless. I tried various things, increasingly loudly, but to no avail. Not one of them moved. It was all a bit humiliating. I had no choice but to turn the boat around and head back to the car. Further along the river, things were just as irritating. There were stretches of the river that were wide enough and deep enough for a rowing boat to travel on comfortably, which flowed gently past attractive fields and houses. Unfortunately, great swathes of the river were either fenced off with barbed wire or were so far from the road as to be inaccessible. There were signs saying, "Baignade interdite," no swimming. Well, if swimming was forbidden, I dreaded to imagine how an uninvited boat launch would be viewed. A bit further on towards Troyes, we at last managed to find a series of launching sites that had everything a potential rower could possibly ask for. A shady place to park, easy access to the water, and a good place downriver to get the boat out again afterwards. Faced with locals who looked as though they were going to protest in some way at uninvited boat launching, Inès came up with a simple but surprisingly effective ploy. She just said, "Excusez-nous, mon mari est anglais." Do excuse us, my husband is English. This is a wonderful sentence. It conveys a complex message in a simple way. It calls for understanding and tolerance, but it is also hoping for a certain degree of pity. In most cases, the person would regard her with deep sorrow and would say something like, "Ah, ma pauvre dame, you poor thing." Then they would back away, smiling sadly, shaking their heads a bit, and doing that despondent, sucking air through the teeth thing that often seems to accompany moments of sympathy or regret in France. Despite the fact that we'd crossed into the Champagne-Ardennes region of France, it didn't occur to me for a minute that we would see any actual champagne. The principal champagne towns, Épernay and Reims, both lie a good 150 kilometres to the north. Reaching the village of Courteron came as something of a surprise, because there were several champagne warehouses standing at intervals down the main road. I was struck by the idea that the ultimate way to taste champagne must surely be to arrive by boat, moor beside the producer's buildings, taste the wine, and row away with a case or two in the boat. Rowing under the influence of champagne was something I was very keen to try. Unfortunately, travelling through the village revealed that the champagne houses all conspicuously turned their backs on the river. We therefore had to resort to finding somewhere to taste champagne in the car. We drove slowly through Gier-sur-Seine and ended up picking a cellar more or less at random. We were greeted by the proprietor, but had barely started chatting to him before a large blue coach drove into the yard.
Oh, merde, les Anglais,
cried the man at the sight of it. Looking at the coach again, I could see that the driver was indeed sitting on the right-hand side. Unfortunately, the proprietor had completely forgotten that an English choir were coming that day for a wine tasting, and he'd failed to warn his son, the only person in the family to speak English, to be there. I tentatively suggested that if we could come and see the cellars too, I would happily translate whatever he had to say, provided that he kept his sentences nice and short. The proprietor, who declared himself somewhat improbably to be called Monsieur Josephine, was delighted. The only time I got badly out of my depth was when he started talking about the way you clear the sediment out of the bottle at the end of the fermentation process. The problem was the word he used, which I heard as égorger. Now, égorger means to slit someone's throat, a term which, even to someone who isn't a champagne specialist, didn't really seem to fit with the rest of what he was saying. In fact, he'd actually said dégorger, which is the proper term for removing the sediment from the bottles. Once the choir was safely back on their coach, everything ended on a very positive note, because Monsieur Josephine came over to our car to give me a bottle of champagne pour la traduction, for the translation. Where the Seine passes through the villages between Châtillon and Troyes, it tends to go past the backs of houses rather than the fronts. Travelling through a village on a boat thus provides a rolling view of yards, gardens, and vegetable patches, and also gives unexpected insights into people's lives. The main thing about rowing a small boat with the current is that it is a fairly quiet way of travelling. If you stop rowing altogether, you drift along making no noise at all. Travelling silently means that you appear completely out of the blue and burst unexpectedly into the lives of the local residents whose houses you're drifting past. Small children playing outside on a sunny afternoon would stop at the sight of the boat and run to the end of their garden to wave and call out a friendly bonjour. In one village I was treated to the sight of a man peeing on his compost heap, doubtless to improve the mix rather than due to any lack of inside amenities, and memorably surprised a couple of sunbathers. When we came to a village called Bellevue, we spotted a sign to somewhere called Essois, which was apparently the home of Renoir. We instantly turned our back on the river and set off to have a look. The road to Essois took us up a hill through woods and then out into a series of vineyards. It was late April, months too early for grapes, but in each field we passed there were men at work. They all had overalls and gloves on and carried tanks of liquid on their backs and could be seen bent over, progressing steadily along the lines of vines. I stopped the car and asked one man near the road what they were doing. He said it was sulfitage, spraying the new shoots with a sulfur-based pesticide. He seemed somewhat less than proud about what he was doing. When I pressed him, he said that more eco-friendly vineyards frown on what they consider a too generous use of chemicals, which they believe do nothing for the soil, and even less for the local flora and fauna. When we finally found Renoir's house, it was just an ordinary-looking 19th-century building with no outward sign that he had lived there. There's no equivalent in France of the standard blue plaque used in the UK to mark the homes of eminent people. The family that now lives there appears to want nothing to do with the previous owner, and our cheery bonjour went unanswered. Back on the river that afternoon, I realised a childhood ambition at long last. When I was about 12, I read a book called The Islanders, about three boys let loose on a country estate in Devon, where they spent the summer having adventures. At one point, one of the boys wants to retrieve something that's fallen into the river. He finds a length of pipe and peers down it into the depths of the river. He called it a see-the-bottomoscope. The previous evening, I'd spotted a short length of plastic drain pipe that someone had dumped by their dustbin. In response to Ines's questions, I launched into a detailed explanation of the islanders. Oh, cried Inès, interrupting me before I could get to the really interesting bit. Why do English children only ever read books about rivers? The water was so clear that I could see right to the bottom of the river. Unsurprisingly, what I mostly saw was long lengths of green weed swaying idly in the current. But there were also fish. The pleasure of seeing them was in no way diminished by the fact that I had no idea what sort of fish they actually were. They were fish, and I could see them, while other people couldn't. That in itself was satisfaction enough. We spent a day exploring the town of Troyes, a splendid place. The next morning, however, things declined considerably. It was one of those overcast, grey, damp mornings with not much wind. Nevertheless, equipped with my waterproof jacket, I launched the boat and headed off downstream. At the precise point where I was exactly too far from the car for it no longer to be practical to turn round and row back, it started to drizzle. But the term drizzle can't properly convey the nature of the constant, fine, chill spray that had started to fall slowly from the clouds. What's more, it managed to fall just slowly enough to make sure that none of it missed me on its way down. Rowing in a cold drizzle, where the movement round to see where you're going opens up your jacket hood at exactly the angle that lets the rain drip down the side of your neck, becomes soul-destroying. We headed on to the village of Marcilly-sur-Seine, where a heated debate arises, for it is near Marcilly that the river Aube joins the Seine. There are those who argue that it is the Seine that joins the Aube rather than the other way round, and that the resulting bigger river that flows on downstream should properly be called the Aube. One afternoon, we nearly lost the boat and our friend Siggy. The wonder of mobile phones means that it is remarkably easy to meet up with people on a riverbank in the middle of nowhere. We thus found ourselves sitting on the grass, enjoying an unexpected beer with Siggy and Christine. Christine asked whether she could go for a row. The ease with which she fitted the oars into their rowlocks clearly showed that she knew one end of a boat from another. I assumed that if a woman was a skilled rower, her husband must be a fairly capable one too. So, when Christine offered to let Siggy take her place, I let him get on with it. Siggy then revealed his Germanic origins by attempting to march his way onto the boat. Under the impact of an off-centre and sizeable German, the poor boat appeared to fly into the air, keel upwards, and, with a huge Teutonic splash, Siggy vanished underwater. A fisherman, sitting quietly a short way along the bank, took stock of the situation and observed, most helpfully,
"Il est tombé dans l'eau."
He's fallen in the water, but made no move to assist us in any way. Long seconds passed. I started, reluctantly, to pull off my shoes with a view to launching a rescue bid when, with the air of a benevolent walrus surfacing after a long and fruitful dive, Siggy's head reappeared. This was to be the end of our exploration for now. It was time to head back home because the people carrier was expected back at work the following day, as indeed was I. More importantly, the confluence with the river Yonne at Montereau-Fauillonne changes the entire character of the river. It is officially declared navigable for the first time. The real risk of being swept aside or swamped by barges and other motorboats meant that once downstream of Montereau, the Seine would no longer be a safe playground for irresponsible little rowing boats. Inès and I carried the boat into the garage. Having made it as comfortable as possible, I turned out the light and quietly closed the garage door, leaving it to reflect on all its adventures.
Episode 2 of An Englishman Aboard, Discovering France in a Rowing Boat by Charles Timoney was read by Mark Heap, abridged by Libby Spurrier and was produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4. Tomorrow, Charles continues his journey in a converted Parisian tourist boat.